384, chapters 13 and 14. Book talk begins at 1026. Book starts at 378. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from where the Delaware River meets the Old York Road, New Hope, Pennsylvania. Episode 384. Happy to you. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Survival Organs, handmade organs to love, throw, or cuddle, and Marchair Yarns, hand-dyed yarns just for you. You can find both at Etsy, and our patrons at patreon.com/craftlit. Visit the site and find out what kinds of rewards await you for supporting Craftlit. All of the supporters can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. And remember, their support for the show is what keeps it free for you. So go have a look. Well, hello. And happy almost Mother's Day to you. In the United States, this Sunday is Mother's Day. So happy Mother's Day. I'm recording this on my birthday, so happy birthday to me. Although I really am, I've kind of stopped with the whole celebrating the birthday thing. It's a little daunting. The closer we get to a big, big marker, the less interested I am about celebrating it. So I think I'm just going to go for a walk today, is what I'm going to do. Nonetheless, to those of you who are mothers, to those of you who have acted like mothers, to those of you who have been thrust into the position of caring for children ever, happy to you. And thank you. Actually, I'll say thank you from the kids, because there's probably not that much that's going to come from them, especially the little ones. Little ones, they don't know how to say thank you to you for being such an awesome mom. So I'll say it instead. Well, this week, the crafty goodness that I bring you is from a science fair we went to. The Franklin Institute in Philadelphia had this amazing outdoor, humongous science fair, and absolutely every business in the area showed up, and they had booths, and all of the booths had placards outside that were questions. And the questions were things like, how can you move an object without touching it? And that was a booth on magnets and how magnets work. Or, can you trust what you perceive? Which was a thing about your senses. So they had you smell little jars, smell inside to see if you could identify the smell without taste or without context, which was actually pretty tricky. And then they had one of those little mirror things where you put a star in and you have to try and draw the star looking in the mirror, and it's very tricky. And I mean, hundreds of booths. But the one that caught my eye was one where the sign was something like, what animal can clean filthy water better than a Brita filter? And in the United States, we have these pitchers that have filters in them, in a top section. You pour the water in, and the water drains through the filtration cartridge, and then you have clean water. So, nifty. Well, I was curious, because that seems like something that would be useful to know, is what animal can clean water better than a Brita filter? Is this something that we should be stocking in our food chain? Where does this fabulous animal live? And the answer is bivalves. Mussels and clams, they filter water better than Brita filters. And to prove it, now we got there at about 11 o'clock. The thing had been open since 9, I think. They had two tanks next to each other. One tank, if you've ever done one of those vacuum tube things and you've vacuumed up the bottom of the gravel of a fish tank that hasn't been cleaned in a long time, you've seen the kind of smoky, cloudy, gunky detritus that comes up from the bottom of the fish tank, that foul-smelling gunk. Not that I've ever done this myself. They had a fish tank that was completely full of that. You couldn't see through it. The murkiness of it was solid. There was no way you would know if something lived in there or not. Next to it was a perfectly lovely aquarium. Water clear as a bell. And there's a lovely little rockscape with little, and I mean little, like not more, the biggest was probably an inch and a half, maybe 2 inches on the outside. Little clammy things attached to the rock and some beach grass on there too. And the water was perfectly clear. And there was a sign on the outside that says, this water, the clear water, looked like that, the dirty water, at 8 a.m. this morning. So that means somewhere between 7 and 10 gallons of water had been completely cleared in 3 hours by this little set of maybe 15 total bivalves. So I went over to the guy and I said, well, wait a minute, this is a really creative solution to a problem, because water, what with it being a limited resource and so much of it going to silly things like toilets and fracking, with the clean water issue looming large on the horizon, especially in places like California, we need to make sure that we can clean what water we have. Do these bivalves that you're talking about, are they only saltwater or are there freshwater varieties? Well, no, there's both saltwater and freshwater. So that's cool. And they all grow near the shore. Well, yes, because some of them, like these mussels, and he was showing me different variations on the theme, these mussels have to be exposed twice a day. So when the tide goes out, they are exposed. The tide comes in. When the tide goes out again, they're exposed again. They need that kind of aeration in order to be able to both survive. They're designed for that, but also to be able to get the food, digest the food, pull the stuff out of the water. They need those breaks. There are other bivalves, clams and some other ones, that don't need to be exposed during their daily cycle. So yes, freshwater, yes, saltwater. Yes, some are trickier than others. The ones that need the exposure are a little trickier to place. And I said, so is this why you see these things on piers and things like that? Is because the water is just dirtier there, and so they have more to eat. And he said, well, yes, that's part of it. And I said, so why aren't we dropping posts into the water from the piers and getting more of these babies on there in order to clean more water more efficiently? It seems to me that we have no end of pollution in the water. This is great. And he said, well, it's largely a matter of funding and awareness. People don't know how important this is. People don't know that there's such a simple solution. And because nobody's really clamoring for it, except for these environmentalist people who work at the Chesapeake Bay and the Delaware Bay projects, these people who were presenting, because they're really the only ones who are calling for it, and nobody else seems to really know about it, nobody's given them any money to do this. And I said, well, what are some of the more inexpensive solutions that people have come up with so far? And he said, well, there are places in Europe where they are dropping lines, thickish, ropish lines, something that the bivalves can grab onto, like a jute rope. And they are dropping those down from underneath piers and docks and things like that, so that these animals have a place to attach, or they are pre-implanting the ropes with bivalves and dropping them. And it is helping. And I thought, ooh, what a crafty approach to a real problem. I love that. And in the same week, Tesla announces that they have a battery for homes. This is huge. My understanding, and I am sure somebody who listens to this show works in this field, and you can call in and give us more information. Call in at 206-350-1642. But my understanding has been that with renewable energy sources, one of the biggest problems has been finding a way to store the energy, that you could have your entire home plastered with photovoltaic panels, and that's great, but you can only use a portion of that energy for your own home. You can try and sell it back to the grid in your area, which is complicated. But what you'd really like to do is be able to store that energy for nighttime. And that's been a problem, evidently, until now. So go Tesla. I'm linking to information on the bivalves, and I'm linking to information on the Tesla battery for you out of the show notes at craftlit.com. But I thought that was pretty cool, and I wanted to share it with you.
Hi, Heather. It's Kathy calling, or Croysor on Ravelry. I'm calling listening to your intro to Sense and Sensibility. In regards to details regarding household management that you mentioned, there are a lot of interesting pieces of information in a book called Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Economics. It's still published, sort of a classic, and it has really fascinating pieces of information about how to prepare food. It has some amazing and undoable recipes in there, how to manage servants, how to take care of horses, how to raise children, all based in Victorian times. I spent many a long and rainy afternoon at my family's house in Wales reading this book, whiling away the hours, and I highly recommend it as a source of information. The other thing to mention that you brought up is sort of what the man's perspective from this time period is regarding relationships. And I think, I know I keep telling you that you need to read Trollope. I've said that to you in a couple of emails. But Trollope has a lot of information about that in his books, or a lot of insights about that, particularly in the Barchester Towers series. He is a man, and there are a lot of male characters. He is not as psychologically sophisticated, I think, as Jane Austen, but still, I think there are some insights to be gained from what he's written, and I just love his books. They're wonderful. So those are two thoughts. Thank you for your wonderful show. I enjoy it so much, and I continue to enjoy listening every week. Take care.
Dear Heather, what a fascinating question you raise, one which never occurred to me before. The only book I can think of, written by a man which comes close to addressing this, is David Copperfield. I'm not sure if you've read it, but that's the book I would have subtitled Husbands and Wives, or maybe Men and Women would be more accurate. Side note, though Dickens is always looking at poverty or injustice of some sort, there are big themes to do with people's relationships in each book, or so it seems to me. So I always thought of Bleak House as happy families, because we saw one happy family and a lot that weren't, for obvious reasons. Dombey and Son could have been called fathers and daughters, except for the mother and daughter cases. Anyway, there were lots of ill-treated daughters in that book. David Copperfield definitely had men and women's relationships under consideration. Spoilers of a sort, if you haven't read David Copperfield. David doesn't marry the girl we all know is perfect for him, though we are longing to have him open his eyes. He marries the girl he's got a strong crush on. What Dickens does with David's gradual realization, and his wife's realization, is one of the most interesting pieces of writing in the book, and one of the most modern-seeming. I wound up really loving that mismatch, and pulling strongly for it as the two made their way into life together. This is all the more interesting because he's got the vivid example of his mother's second marriage, which was a terrible mismatch to someone who crushed her spirit, and, which was even more interesting, who was terribly broken up when she died, showing that he wasn't just a brute, or at least not solely a brute. We certainly can't love the way that he treats David. Because we see David's point of view, we also see those feelings you mentioned, although after he marries. We just assume he wants the things that a woman would want. To be with the one he loves forever. This perhaps isn't exactly what you were asking about, but it definitely sprang to mind when you raised the question. Cheers, Julie, at Forgotten Classics.
So I thought that was fairly interesting, what Kathy had to say, and then leading into what Julie had to say. So now I'm going to go back and look at David Copperfield again, because that is pretty cool. And I thought both of those messages led very nicely into today. Sense and Sensibility. Well, last time Colonel Brandon was getting ready to take everyone to his brother-in-law's ancestral home, which tells us a couple of things. His sister married well, so that's great. And there was also something about him not wanting Brandon's friends to just show up. Brandon needed to be with them, which is kind of cool because that means that Brandon, who Willoughby and Marianne keep making fun of for being kind of dour and kind of down and kind of meh, 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 that he's going to have to head out and have some fun with everybody. So that's kind of nice. We're going to get to see a new side of Colonel Brandon. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see if Willoughby is capable of saying, oh, well, yeah, today Brandon was kind of fun. Well, for today's chapters, chapters 13 and 14, we have a few things actually that refer back to things that we discussed back on Persuasion. One of those is that for wealthy people at this time, they kept awfully late hours at night, which means they're going to be getting up later. And because part of what they're doing when they're up late at night is eating, their breakfast time is later in the morning as well. And I'm constantly thinking, wow, this would be a horrible setup for the servants in a home like this because they're going to be expected to be up late and up early. That can't be good for them, right? Well, along with seeing more information about how the house hours work in today's chapters, one of the other things that we're going to get to see is decorum and proper behavior among gentle people when a problem crops up. Who do you talk to? Who do you make your apologies to? How do you properly discuss something that's kind of surprising and, oh, well, what are we going to do now moments? And usually these scenes that we see are fairly mannered and laid out and they proceed in a logical order. Rarely are these surprises. And we're going to get one of those surprises today. So it's going to be an opportunity to see who is supposed to talk to whom and when, which is kind of fun. And we had talked before about wealthy people's incomes, that you had your estate, which might be worth a certain number of thousands of pounds, and then the amount of money that you would draw on that estate as interest that you would live on. So bringing in, as the women do, hundreds, not very many hundreds of pounds a year to live on, that being the interest, and knowing that a servant at this time might be lucky, a household servant, not just a scullery maid, but a household maid might make 12 pounds a year. You're going to hear some amounts of money thrown around at various times during the chapters today. Just keep that in the back of your mind. A servant doing pretty well would make maybe 12 pounds a year. Oh, and a guinea is a pound and a shilling, which I know there are reasons for these demarcations in money. Like, we were at a colonial someplace in Virginia, and they gave the kids pieces of eight, and these were coins, actual coins, that had been cut into eight pieces. So it was a wedge-shaped triangle, like a pie piece, like a Trivial Pursuit piece. And this is how the money was made into smaller denominations for a time, was to actually cut the coin. Because, of course, at that point in time, a coin would have been worth its weight. So if it was a silver coin, it would have been worth its weight in silver. So cutting it into a smaller piece made a lot of sense at the time. Anyway, a guinea is one type of coin. It's no longer in circulation, but when it was originally used, it was one of the first machine-struck coins. It was gold coin. It was originally worth £1, which was the same as 20 shillings. But the price of gold kept fluctuating. And so eventually, in 1816, so shortly after this book was published, the price was set at 21 shillings. So that would be £1 and 1 shilling. Or £1.05. Evidently, the term guinea is still used when horse racing, people are betting on horse races, and selling and buying sheep and rams. Who knew? But eventually England went on the gold standard, and once that happened, then all of this was moot. There was no such thing as a guinea anymore, except in horse racing and buying and selling of certain livestock. And again, as long as you keep in mind that 12 pounds was about what you could make as a servant, roughly, broad strokes there, and that the women in the story, our women, our Dashwood women, are living on just 500 pounds a year. That'll give you some information that you can use to judge monetary amounts as you hear them coming by in today's chapters. Now, I did come across an interesting piece of societal etiquette from this period, and that is this. We've been so used to, for the last few books on craft lit, finding that in the Victorian world, if one was hosting a meal, one would have to set everyone male, female, all the way around, so that you had the genders at the table broken up and assumedly in equal or relatively equal numbers. During this time period, at a casual, or at least not very formal, multi-family party event, one would be able to, during this time period, seat oneself within, you know, general frameworks. You wouldn't want to sit next to someone who you were known to have affection for unless another member of your family were nearby, or unless there was someone else nearby to kind of chaperone you and things like that. So that was one kind of interesting thing I learned. And then another thing was kind of going along with that whole servants up late and wealthy people not getting up early but staying up and eating very late. The morning lasted until dinner, which could be as late as 4 in the afternoon, according to one of my sources. Anyway, morning was a long time for Jane Austen, which means that if you were out all morning, you were really out for quite a long time. Remember that Willoughby's mode of transportation was a curricle, and the home that he is supposed to inherit is called Allenham, A-L-L-E-N-H-A-M, and it's owned currently by a Mrs. Smith who's some kind of invalid. We don't know exactly what's going on, but she's evidently not well enough to mix with society. But Willoughby does actually have his own estate. He's not there right now. He's staying at Allenham, but he does have his own estate, and it's called Combe Magna. It's C-O-M-B-E, and then Magna, M-A-G-N-A. And we hear about it for the first time in passing today, and more about it later on. You will hear a term, a hanging wood. This is not like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. This is what happens when trees are growing on a slope. They start to tilt at an angle, and their branches, instead of growing out from the center trunk, all kind of hang down towards, you know, the ground. Gravity, that thing, is at work on the tree. So that's a hanging wood. What a great name for something that I've seen my whole life when I've been stomping around outside, but never had a very good way to describe it. Now I do. It's a hanging wood. If an estate is referred to as being involved, that was another way of saying that there's an entailment. There's some kind of financial debt that's needing to be repaid, or that the estate itself has been signed over, kind of like what happened with Persuasion. Remember, the family could no longer afford to stay in their ancestral home because the father was so bad with money and he wound up with too many debts, and so their estate was involved and they had to live somewhere else. One of the things that we've only touched on in the past, and actually we haven't really had a book that required us to deal with this a whole lot before, now that I think about it, horses. If you were going to start down that road of owning horses at this time, and if you were a gentleman, you weren't going to just have a horse for you, a horse that could be used with other horses as a team for carriages, and then use that same horse for hunting and use that same horse for just kind of general riding. Oh no. Different horses did different jobs and were trained for different jobs. You didn't want to put a hunting horse in as part of a team on a carriage. That would be bad because that horse isn't used to running with other horses or probably even wearing blinders or blinkers. So if you are a gentleman who likes to hunt, you would have to have your carriage horses, your single riding horses, and hunting horses. This is extraordinarily expensive. You have to have, number one, the space for them, number two, the money for food for them, and number three, the appropriate number of grooms for them. And you needed to have servants, possibly the grooms, but also maybe not, maybe enough servants in the house that if you had to go somewhere in a hurry, you brought the groom along. If you had a woman in the family who rode, at least the groom, if not a servant, had to go riding with her. She couldn't go off on her own. That would have been just not done. So there are so many different layers of expense that go along with horse owning. But the one that really surprised me was realizing the logic, the very obvious and clear logic, but something that hadn't occurred to me before, of the different types of horses for the different jobs, which just all adds to that expense, which is one of the reasons why people in the city didn't own horses very often. And after coming across this term for 40 some odd years, I finally decided to look up its origin. Drawing room. We have heard this term hundreds of times in the past on Craftlit. And I finally looked it up and it's really cool. It wasn't always called a drawing room. It was originally called a withdrawing room. You would meet in the parlor, and then anybody who you were going to spend more time with or a more intimate acquaintance with, you would withdraw to a slightly inner room from the parlor. Two places where I read this being used that made so much sense was in the White House. The president met people in the parlor, and then the people who he needed to talk with more intimately, he withdrew to the drawing room with, and that was where they talked. Or after a formal dinner, the ladies would withdraw to the drawing room, and the men would still sit around the table and smoke and drink, and then join the ladies in the drawing room. And that is where that term comes from. Makes so much sense, doesn't it? Oh, and there are also drawing room plays. I remember this. The Importance of Being Earnest, or Tartuffe, or the one with Mrs. Malaprop. Oh, Sheridan's play, The Rivals. These were all examples of drawing room comedies, mostly, or drawing room plays. Drawing rooms in smaller homes would have been the rooms that were off of the main entrance. And a main entranceway could be big enough to actually entertain people in some homes. But the drawing room would be where you withdrew to from that main entrance and sat with your guests. A living room, in comparison, would be a room further into the house and possibly even on a second floor, but further into the house that would be where the family would sit together, not where you would entertain necessarily. And I think that is everything you could possibly need for today's chapters. Chapters 13 and 14 of Sense and Sensibility by Jane Austen. Here we go.
Chapter 13. Their intended excursion to Whitwell turned out very different from what Eleanor had expected. She was prepared to be wet through, fatigued and frightened, but the event was still more unfortunate, for they did not go at all. By 10 o'clock the whole party was assembled at the park, where they were to breakfast. The morning was rather favourable, though it had rained all night, as the clouds were then dispersing across the sky and the sun frequently appeared. They were all in high spirits and good humour, eager to be happy and determined to submit to the greatest inconveniences and hardships rather than be otherwise. While they were at breakfast, the letters were brought in. Among the rest, there was one for Colonel Brandon. He took it, looked at the direction, changed colour, and immediately left the room. "What is the matter with Brandon?" said Sir John. Nobody could tell. "I hope he has had no bad news," said Lady Middleton. "It must be something extraordinary that could make Colonel Brandon leave my breakfast table so suddenly." In about 5 minutes he returned. "No bad news, Colonel, I hope," said Mrs. Jennings, as soon as he entered the room.
"None at all, ma'am, I thank you."
"Was it from Avignon? I hope it's not to say that your sister is worse."
"No, ma'am. It came from town. It's merely a letter of business."
"But how came the hand to discompose you so much if it was only a letter of business? Come, come, this won't do, Colonel, so let us hear the truth of it." "My dear madam," said Lady Middleton, "recollect what you are saying." "Perhaps it's to tell you that your cousin Fanny is married," said Mrs. Jennings, without attending to her daughter's reproof.
"No, indeed, it is not."
"Well, then, I know who it is from, Colonel, and I hope she is well."
"Whom do you mean, ma'am?" he said, colouring a little.
"Oh, you know who I mean."
"I'm particularly sorry, ma'am," he said, addressing Lady Middleton, "that I should receive this letter today, for it is on business which requires my immediate attendance in town."
"In town?" cried Mrs. Jennings. "What can you have to do in town at this time of year?"
"My own loss is great," he continued, "in being obliged to leave so agreeable a party, but I'm the more concerned as I fear my presence is necessary to gain your admittance at Whitwell." What a blow upon them all was this!
"But if you write a note to the housekeeper, Mr. Brandon," said Marianne eagerly, "will it not be sufficient?"
He shook his head.
"We must go," said Sir John. "It shall not be put off when we are so near to it. You cannot go to town till tomorrow, Brandon, that is all."
"I wish it could be so easily settled, but it is not in my power to delay my journey for one day."
"If you would but let us know what your business is," said Mrs. Jennings, "we might see whether it could be put off or not."
"You would not be 6 hours later," said Willoughby, "if you were to defer your journey till our return." "I cannot afford to lose 1 hour." Eleanor then heard Willoughby say in a low voice to Marianne, "There are some people who cannot bear a party of pleasure. Brandon is one of them. He was afraid of catching cold, I dare say, and invented this trick for getting out of it. I would lay 50 guineas the letter was of his own writing."
"I have no doubt of it," replied Marianne.
"There is no persuading you to change your mind, Brandon. I know of old," said Sir John, "when once you are determined on anything. But, however, I hope you will think better of it. Consider, here are the 2 Miss Careys come over from Newton, and the 3 Miss Dashwoods walked up from the cottage, and Mr. Willoughby got up 2 hours before his usual time on purpose to go to Whitwell." Colonel Brandon again repeated his sorrow at being the cause of disappointing the party, but at the same time declared it to be unavoidable.
"Well then, when will you come back again?"
"I hope we shall see you at Barton," added her ladyship, "as soon as you can conveniently leave town, and we must put off the party to Whitwell till your return."
"You are very obliging, but it is so uncertain when I may have it in my power to return that I dare not engage for it at all."
"Oh, he must and shall come back," cried Sir John. "If he is not here by the end of the week, I shall go after him."
"I do so, Sir John," cried Mrs. Jennings. "Then perhaps you might find out what his business is."
"I do not want to pry into other men's concerns. I suppose it is something he is ashamed of."
Colonel Brandon's horses were announced.
"You do not go to town on horseback, do you?" added Sir John.
"No, only to Honiton. I shall then go post."
"Well, as you are resolved to go, I wish you a good journey. But you had better change your mind."
"I assure you, it is not in my power." He then took leave of the whole party. "Is there no chance of my seeing you and your sisters in town this winter, Miss Dashwood?"
"I am afraid none at all."
"Then I must bid you farewell for a longer time than I should wish to do." To Marianne he merely bowed and said nothing.
Come, Colonel, said Mrs. Jennings, before you go, do let us know what you're going about.
He wished her a good morning, and attended by Sir John, left the room. The complaints and lamentations which politeness had hitherto restrained now burst forth universally, and they all agreed again and again how provoking it was to be so disappointed.
I can guess what his business is, however, said Mrs. Jennings exultingly.
Can you, ma'am? Said almost everybody.
Yes, it is about Miss Williams, I'm sure.
And who is Miss Williams? Asked Marianne.
What? Do you not know who Miss Williams is? I'm sure you must have heard of her before. She's a relation of the Colonel's, my dear. A very near relation. We will not say how near, for fear of shocking the young ladies.
Then, lowering her voice a little, she said to Eleanor, She is his natural daughter.
Indeed. Oh, yes, and as like him as she can stare. I dare say the Colonel will leave her all his fortune.
When Sir John returned, he joined most heartily in the general regret on so unfortunate an event, concluding, however, by observing that as they were all got together, they must do something by the way of being happy. And after some consultation, it was agreed that although happiness could only be enjoyed at Whitwell, they might procure a tolerable composure of mind by driving about the country. The carriages were then ordered. Willoughby's was first, and Marianne never looked happier than when she got into it. He drove through the park very fast, and they were soon out of sight, and nothing more of them was seen till their return, which did not happen till after the return of all the rest. They both seemed delighted with their drive, but said only in general terms that they had kept in the lanes while the others went on the downs. It was settled that there should be a dance in the evening, and that everybody should be extremely merry all day long. Some more of the Careys came to dinner, and they had the pleasure of sitting down nearly 20 to table, which Sir John observed with great contentment. Willoughby took his usual place between the two elder Miss Dashwoods. Mrs. Jennings sat on Eleanor's right hand, and they had not long been seated before she leant behind her on Willoughby and said to Marianne, loud enough for them both to hear, "I have found you out in spite of all your tricks. I know where you spent the morning." Marianne coloured and replied very hastily, "Where, pray?"
"Did you not know," said Willoughby, "that we have been out in my curricle?"
"Yes, yes, Mr. Impudence, I know that very well, and I was determined to find out where you had been to. I hope you like your house, Miss Marianne. It is a very large one, I know, and when I come to see you I hope you will have new furnished it, for it wanted it very much when I was there 6 years ago."
Marianne turned away in great confusion. Mrs. Jennings laughed heartily, and Eleanor found that in her resolution to know where they had been, she had actually made her own woman inquire of Mr. Willoughby's groom, and that she had by that method been informed that they had gone to Allenham, and spent a considerable time in there, walking round the garden and going all over the house. Eleanor could hardly believe this to be true, as it seemed very unlikely that Willoughby should propose or Marianne consent to enter the house while Mrs. Smith was in it, with whom Marianne had not the smallest acquaintance. As soon as they left the dining room, Eleanor inquired of her about it, and great was her surprise when she found that every circumstance related by Mrs. Jennings was perfectly true. Marianne was quite angry with her for doubting it.
"Why should you imagine, Eleanor, that we did not go there, or that we did not see the house? Is it not what you have often wished to do yourself?"
"Yes, Marianne, but I would not go while Mrs. Smith was there, and with no other companion than Mr. Willoughby."
"Mr. Willoughby, however, is the only person who can have a right to show that house, and as he went in an open carriage it was impossible to have any other companion. I have never spent a pleasanter morning in my life."
"I'm afraid," replied Eleanor, "that the pleasantness of an employment does not always evince its propriety."
"On the contrary, nothing can be a stronger proof of it, Eleanor, for if there'd been any real impropriety in what I did, I should have been sensible of it at the time, for we have always known when we are acting wrong, and with such a conviction I could have had no pleasure. But my dear Marianne, as it has already exposed you to some very impertinent remarks, do you not now begin to doubt the discretion of your own conduct? If the impertinent remarks of Mrs. Jennings are to be the proof of impropriety in conduct, we are all offending every moment of our lives.
I value not her censure any more than I should do her commendation. I'm not sensible of having done anything wrong in walking over Mrs. Smith's grounds, or in seeing her house. They will one day be Mr. Willoughby's, and if they were one day to be your own, Marianne, you would not be justified in what you have done." She blushed at this hint, but it was even visibly gratifying to her, and after a 10 minutes' interval of earnest thought, she came to her sister again, and said with great good humour, "Perhaps, Eleanor, it was rather ill-judged in me to go to Allingham, but Mr. Willoughby wanted particularly to show me the place, and it is a charming house, I assure you. There's one remarkably pretty sitting room upstairs, of a nice comfortable size for constant use, and with modern furniture it would be delightful. It's a corner room, and has windows on two sides. On one side you look across the bowling green, behind the house, to a beautiful hanging wood, and on the other you had a view of the church and village, and beyond them those fine bold hills that we've so often admired. I did not see it to advantage, for nothing could be more forlorn than the furniture, but if it were newly fitted up, a couple of £100, Willoughby said, would make it one of the pleasantest summer rooms in England." Could Eleanor have listened to her without interruption from the others, she would have described every room in the house with equal delight. Chapter 14. The sudden termination of Colonel Brandon's visit at the park, with his steadiness in concealing its cause, filled the mind and raised the wonder of Mrs. Jennings for 2 or 3 days. She was a great wanderer, as everyone must be who takes a very lively interest in all the comings and goings of all their acquaintance. She wondered with very little intermission what could be the reason of it, was sure there must be some bad news, and thought over every kind of distress that could have befallen him with a fixed determination that he should not escape them all. "Something very melancholy must be the matter, I'm sure," she said. "I could see it in his face, poor man, and I'm afraid his circumstances may be bad. The estate at Delaford was never reckoned more than 2,000 a year, and his brother left everything sadly involved. I do think he must have been sent for about money matters, for what else can it be? I wonder whether it is so. I would give anything to know the truth of it. Perhaps it is about Miss Williams, and by the by, I dare say it is, because he looked so conscious when I mentioned her. Maybe she is ill in town. Nothing in the world more likely, for I have a notion she is always rather sickly. I would lay any wager it is about Miss Williams. It is not so very likely he should be distressed in his circumstances now, for he is a very prudent man, and to be sure must have cleared the estate by this time. I wonder what it can be. Maybe his sister is worse at Avignon, and has sent for him over. His sitting off in such a hurry seems very like it. Well, I wish him out of all his trouble, with all my heart, and a good wife into the bargain." So wandered, so talked Mrs. Jennings, her opinion varying with every fresh conjecture, and all seeming equally probable as they arose. Eleanor, though she felt really interested in the welfare of Colonel Brandon, could not bestow all the wonder on his going so suddenly away, which Mrs. Jennings was desirous of her feeling. For, besides that the subject did not in her opinion justify such lasting amazement or variety of speculation, her wonder was otherwise disposed of. It was engrossed by the extraordinary silence of her sister and Willoughby on the subject, which they must know to be particularly interesting to them all. As this silence continued, every day made it appear more strange and more incompatible with the disposition of both. Why they should not openly acknowledge to her mother and herself what their constant behaviour to each other declared to have taken place, Eleanor could not imagine. She could easily conceive that marriage might not be immediately in their power, for though Willoughby was independent, there was no reason to believe him rich. His estate had been rated by Sir John at about 600 or 700 a year, but he lived at an expense to which that income could hardly be equal, and he had himself often complained of his poverty. But for this strange kind of secrecy maintained by them relative to their engagement, which in fact concealed nothing at all, she could not account. And it was so wholly contradictory to their general opinions and practice that a doubt sometimes entered into her mind of their being really engaged, and this doubt was enough to prevent her making any inquiry of Marianne. Nothing could be more expressive of attachment to them all than Willoughby's behaviour. To Marianne it had all the distinguishing tenderness which a lover's heart could give,
and to the rest of the family it was the affectionate attention of a son and a brother. The cottage seemed to be considered and loved by him as his home. Many more of his hours were spent there than at Allenham, and if no general engagement collected them at the park, the exercise which called him out in the morning was almost certain of ending there, where the rest of the day was spent by himself at the side of Marianne and by his favourite pointer at her feet. One evening in particular, about a week after Colonel Brandon left the country, his heart seemed more than usually open to every feeling of attachment to the objects around him, and on Mrs. Dashwood's happening to mention her design of improving the cottage in the spring, he warmly opposed every alteration of a place which affection had established as perfect with him.
"What?" he exclaimed. "Improve this dear cottage? No, that I will never consent to. Not a stone must be added to its walls, not an inch to its size, if my feelings are regarded."
"Do not be alarmed," said Miss Dashwood. "Nothing of the kind will be done, for my mother will never have money enough to attempt it."
"I am heartily glad of it," he cried. "May she always be poor if she can employ her riches no better."
"Thank you, Willoughby, but you may be assured that I would not sacrifice one sentiment of local attachment of yours, or of anyone whom I loved, for all the improvements in the world. Depend upon it, that whatever unemployed sum may remain when I make up my accounts in the spring, I would even rather lay it useless by than dispose of it in a manner so painful to you. But are you really so attached to this place as to see no defect in it?"
"I am," said he. "To me it is faultless. Nay, more, I consider it as the only form of building in which happiness is attainable, and were I rich enough, I would instantly pull Coombe down and build it up again in the exact plan of this cottage."
"With dark narrow stairs and a kitchen that smokes, I suppose," said Eleanor.
"Yes," cried he in the same eager tone, "with all and everything belonging to it. In no one convenience or inconvenience about it should the least variation be perceptible. Then, and then only, under such a roof, I might perhaps be as happy at Coombe as I have been at Barton."
"I flatter myself," replied Eleanor, "that even under the disadvantage of better rooms and a broader staircase, you will hereafter find your own house as faultless as you now do this."
"There certainly are circumstances," said Willoughby, "which might greatly endear it to me. But this place will always have one claim on my affection, which no other can possibly share." Mrs. Dashwood looked with pleasure at Marianne, whose fine eyes were fixed so expressively on Willoughby as plainly denoted how well she understood him. "How often did I wish," added he, "when I was at Allenham this time 12 months, that Barton Cottage were inhabited, and I never passed within view of it without admiring its situation and grieving that no one should live in it. How little did I then think that the very first news I should hear from Mrs. Smith, when I next came into the country, would be that Barton Cottage was taken, and I felt an immediate satisfaction and interest in the event, which nothing but a kind of prescience of what happiness I should experience from it can account for. Must it not have been so, Marianne?" speaking to her in a lowered voice. Then, continuing in his former tone, he said, "And yet this house you would spoil, Mrs. Dashwood. You would rob it of its simplicity by imaginary improvement. And this dear parlour, in which our acquaintance first began, and in which so many happy hours have been since spent by us together, you would degrade to the condition of a common entrance, and everybody would be eager to pass through the room, which has hitherto contained within itself more real accommodation and comfort than any other apartment of the handsomest dimensions in the world could possibly afford." Mrs. Dashwood again assured him that no alteration of the kind should be attempted. "You are a good woman," he warmly replied. "Your promise makes me easy. Extend it a little farther, and it will make me happy. Tell me not only that your house will remain the same, but that I shall ever find you and yours as unchanged as your dwelling, and that you will always consider me with the kindness which has made everything belonging to you so dear to me." The promise was readily given, and Willoughby's behaviour during the whole of the evening declared at once his affection and happiness. "Shall we see you tomorrow to dinner?" said Mrs. Dashwood, when he was leaving them. "I do not ask you to come in the morning, for we must walk to the park to call on Lady Middleton." He engaged to be with them by 4 o'clock.
So, Willoughby, That was a kind of a curious scene with Willoughby, don't you think? I'm not entirely sure how I'm feeling about this, for a couple of reasons. First, Mrs. Dashwood was not going to change her plans about making alterations to the cottage for the reasons of financial resources. She wasn't even considering it. Oh, I'm sure I'll have the money in the spring. Magically, from a genie. But when Willoughby says, don't change a thing, she says, oh, okay. Of course not. We would never do that to you, Willoughby.
Huh.
But I also thought that his entire reaction exposed something about him. Eleanor says it is a joke, but it really isn't a joke. That the stairs are too narrow and dark, and the fireplace smokes, and this is not something that's easy to live with, either of them. Dark, narrow stairs were dangerous for women who had to wear these dresses, and a fireplace that smokes, this was a very common problem, actually. And again, if your main source of heating and cooking is a fireplace, living with one that backpuffs into your house is really not a lot of fun. And it's not healthy. It's not good for you either. You're breathing in all the smoke and particulate matter. This is not a great thing. Willoughby, however, couldn't stand to have any part of this room of perfection, this home that has welcomed him and made him so happy he couldn't stand to have any part of it changed, which is a lovely romantic idea. But he doesn't seem to be being merely romantic. He does seem kind of desperate about this. And it also does expose something interesting about Mrs. Dashwood as well, because of all of the improvements, quote unquote, that she said she was going to make to the cottage, neither of them improved the lighting on the stairs or the fireplace. Hers were all, you know, enlarge this room and push out this wall and let's make it bigger so that we could have more parties and stuff like that. So, we learn a little bit about both of them. Now, just prior to Willoughby's exclamation of protest, Eleanor had a little interesting thought paragraph. She was thinking about Willoughby and that Sir John had raided his estate, you know, just kind of estimating, well, his estate probably brings in about $600 or $700 a year. So he's living on, as a single man, not a whole lot more than the Dashwood women are living on, which sounds like, oh, well, that should be easy. He should be doing just fine. It's just him, which is true, except we've heard what some of his expenses are, and it's actually not that much compared to the horses and the hunting and the clothes and the curricle and all of this stuff. And in fact, she says he has often complained of his poverty. Now, he does not mean poverty when he says poverty. He just means he doesn't have enough money to do all the things that he wants to do. And that's fairly typical of this class. When they plead poverty, they really just mean, oh, I don't have enough to do that thing that everyone is doing or everyone else wants to do. But then Eleanor goes on to say something important about Marianne. Well, Marianne and Willoughby, actually, both of them. She says, but for the strange kind of secrecy maintained by them relative to their engagement, which in fact concealed nothing at all, she could not account. And it was so wholly contradictory to their general opinions and practice that a doubt sometimes entered her mind of their being really engaged. And this doubt was enough to prevent her making any inquiry of Marianne. This is fairly serious because part of that whole sensibility cult that Marianne and Willoughby ascribe themselves to is honesty and sincerity. And we've seen this before. This is the, well, yes, you do look fat in that sincerity. And yet, the first time that we come across them having something that's really important, that they really need to be sincere about. Society demands that they be sincere about this. They're hiding something. And they're not making an announcement. Nothing that Marianne and Willoughby did in these two chapters are appropriate for a couple that is not engaged. Riding off alone in a carriage? Uh-uh. Riding off alone in a carriage for the entire morning, which means it could have been 4 o'clock by the time they finally showed up again? No. These things were not done. Going and visiting the home that Willoughby is supposed to be inheriting? No. No, 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 no. These are things we do not do. Mm-mm. But because there's this huge gap between Marianne's kind of personal philosophy and her behavior right now, and because another person is involved, Willoughby, Eleanor doesn't want to embarrass Marianne by pushing her to explain this, because the only explanations that Eleanor can come up with are kind of embarrassing. And so she's not going to go there. Eleanor's a good egg. And that whole chapter, chapter 13, of Colonel Brandon having to leave and then going off and Willoughby and Marianne seeing the home, the Colonel Brandon thing first. A natural child is one that is yours by nature, but not by law. No marriage involved. So that's a nice term, natural child. And so that is shocking. Colonel Brandon, what do you mean to tell us about your past? And Mrs. Jennings, woo, thanks, Miss Jennings, for spilling those beans. Woof. That was a big surprise ball to drop on the party, or at least on Eleanor. And in fact, all the more shocking that it got dropped on Eleanor, because Eleanor is only 19 and she's unmarried. And part of the reasoning behind not talking about these kinds of things in front of the young women, you know, was because you didn't want them to start thinking about how that natural child came to be. That would lead them down a road of thinking about all sorts of things that they simply should not be thinking about right now. And in fact, was one of the reasons why girls, women, young women were sometimes restricted about the kinds of books that they could read, like Tom Jones and things like that. That would be, oh no, you can't let them start to think about those things, or God forbid, explain them to them, because then they'll run off with the next guy they meet, I guess, was the thinking. I'm not sure. But, you know, just avoid the whole problem by not talking about it. Sound logic, obviously. Now, I found a note that cracked me up about this particular scene, that in an earlier draft of this novel, Jane Austen wrote the following. After Mrs. Jennings said, "Oh yes, and as like him as she can stare, I dare say the colonel will leave her all his fortune." The original paragraph that followed said, "Lady Middleton's delicacy was shocked, and in order to banish so improper a subject as the mention of a natural daughter, she actually took the trouble of saying something herself about the weather." Oh, my sensibilities are so distraught. I will say, ooh, it's a lovely day. I didn't expect us not to have rain after last night when it poured. So the whole escapade with Willoughby and with Marianne running off to Allenham and looking around the house for hours, and then having had conversations, because Marianne is clearly parroting one later when she says, oh, and the, you know, this charming room, and for only £200 be able to refurnish it so nicely. Well, that was a conversation then, because that's something that Willoughby said, right? That sounds like something that Willoughby must have said to her and that she is then repeating to Eleanor. That's a real serious conversation to have with a woman who you're not married to, and odd. But the other thing that this whole sequence exposes is part of how Marianne's brain works. When Eleanor says, "I'm afraid that the pleasantness of an employment does not always evince its propriety," just because you're having a good time doesn't mean that it's the right thing to be doing. Marianne comes back and says, "On the contrary, nothing can be a stronger proof of it, Eleanor. For if there had been any real impropriety in what I did, I should have been sensible of it at the time. For we always know when we are acting wrong, and with such a conviction, I could have had no pleasure. If it was wrong, it would have felt wrong, and I would have stopped. Obviously, right? Because if it feels good, do it. You can see where this goes into the romantic movement, but then you can also see how it's reflected in like the late 1960s and the 70s, that if it feels good, do it attitude. Because how could it be wrong if it's natural? If it's natural and you feel it, you know you just should go with it because you wouldn't be feeling it if it weren't just an honest, natural, open thing. And how could anything natural be wrong? I joke, but actually it wasn't a joke. This really was part of a larger philosophical debate at the time. And it was a big one because either morality is an external, separate thing that you learn to logically and morally think through a problem, or you are kind of endowed by God made man in his image thing. You are endowed, therefore, with inherent goodness. And if you do something that comes from some imprecisely located natural impulse, then that has to be good because God is good, and therefore I am good. And therefore, anything that I want to do without pressure or prejudice from the outside, anything that just comes to me as something that I want to do, it must ipso facto be good. And Eleanor's trying to gently let Marianne know that maybe not so much. And this actually comes up in a couple of different Jane Austen novels. There are often characters, not so much a girl as often, but there are characters in other books of hers who are very, if it feels good, do it. That is just the easiest way to explain them. And then they're kind of stupefied that anyone could possibly be upset by their conduct when they were just following their natural instinct. How could you possibly get mad at me about that? I was just doing the natural thing. And I think we can see that Jane Austen did not ascribe to that point of view quite so strongly as some of her characters do. Interesting philosophical conundrum. And that is where we will leave it for today. Next week we have 15 and 16. We're just cruising along. There are many chapters, but we're cruising along. We're doing well. And so I leave you. Don't forget, all sorts of goodies are over at patreon.com, including video updates. And I'm switching out some of the Patreon rewards, so new stuff is going to be going up, and that's about all I can tell you about right now. All right, have a great one. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
Heather, my friend, I apologize for being late for the anniversary podcast, but I'm leaving this message anyway. Thank you for Craftlit. I'm not sure exactly when I started listening, but I feel like I've been listening since the beginning, because once I did find you, I went back and listened to every single preceding episode. You have traveled with me to Mexico, to Singapore, to Boston, to New York, to the Sierra Mountains in the Gold Country. You have gone so many places with me. You have been beside me through crazy work projects and cleaning my house and stressing out over raising teenage girls. You felt like my friend before we ever started emailing each other, but then you became my friend, and you are a very unusual friend in that we are close. I can ask you anything. I can check up on you in any area of your life, and you can do the same with me, yet we've never met in person. Thank you for the entertainment. Thank you for helping my brain not rot as a stay-at-home mom. And thank you for giving me the chance to participate in the Defarge books and for getting me started on the path to a new career.
I love you, and in case you haven't guessed, this is Erica, Erica, age 64. Hi.
Hi, Heather. It's Gabrielle from Berkeley. Gabby. So I did start listening to Craftlit in 2010 when we moved to New York, and I was Dracula was the first book. And no, I don't remember how exactly, but it, what was great was it gave me company when I was doing things by myself, and specifically when I was making dinner and things like that, when my daughter was napping and I was still pregnant with my son. And the other thing it did was it both satisfied and piqued my teaching interest, and it sort of scratched my itch and made my itch need bigger scratching, because you talk about the books in a way that reminds me of me. And I think I said, I don't know if I've ever said that to you directly, but I think most teachers would probably say, remind us of when we talk about books, is being able to really talk about the books with our students and help them get to the aha moments, the connections that, especially for teens, they might be so close to, or to allow them to discover them themselves. And it's just really fun to listen along and think about teaching, how I would teach this book now in the classroom if I were to teach again. And that part of it has been just my own little thing as I've gone along and listened and thought, I want to do that too, or I would like to bring this to the classroom or as a student. So it's given me multiple experiences that I've done along with you. That makes more sense and slightly more clear. All right, Dave, lovely. And your spring is finally springing. And we'll listen and talk to you soon. Bye.